free my mind. Open my heart with the whispers of truth. To live a conscious life, to live a conscious life. On the growing edge, on the growing edge.
And now, here's Allie.
Welcome back to Growing Edge Live. It's so good to be here today. I always get so excited when it's going to be Monday and I have a conversation with another amazing spirit, a soul. And Growing Edge Live is all about having conversations with people that are on the very growing edge of their own creation. People that are channeling their time, their talent, energy, their love, creativity, their resources into doing good work in the world. And so every week we come together to have a conversation with someone that's doing just that. And today I have the great blessing and honor to be interviewing and having a conversation with Dr. Jim Lockhart. But before we get to Jim, I'd like to move into the segment Ask Allie. And today I have a question, and this question comes from Gina. And Gina says, what is spiritual sovereignty and why is it important in my life? I love this question. I have considered the idea of spiritual sovereignty as sort of being my mantra for the last couple of years. And so I've been exploring this notion of really being self-governing, self-determining, and independent. And when you combine the two words, spiritual and sovereignty, to me it means that we have a particular independence and a particular ownership over our spiritual growth and development. And so that's the sort of the foundational premise. And so as someone that is spiritually sovereign, we have an idea that we're all connected, not just an idea, but we have a felt realization that we're all connected, interdependent, interrelated. And when we come to this realization that we're all part of this whole, this one beautiful life that is constantly evolving and changing and growing, and each one of us radically unique, differentiated beings are all participating in this growth, in this evolution. And so when we become aware of this, we begin to see that whatever we're doing in our little corner of the world, in our life, affects everything else. And so we want to do better. We want to rise up and be more positive and shine our light and serve others around us and humanity in general, because we're all connected. And so wouldn't it make sense that we direct our energy into doing the things that we think will be sort of harness our own skills and talents and bring those in service of our purpose in life. And so someone that's spiritually sovereign has an idea of who they are and why they're here. And they usually have gone about organizing their energy and their wisdom to be able to channel that and raise up everyone around them. And so when you're stating that you're spiritually sovereign, you then have a sense of presence about you. You're deeply grounded in your own life. You're deeply aware that this now moment is really the point of creation. It always has been. We don't create in the past, and we don't create in the future, although the future is affected by our creation in the now. And so we become very interested in doing the inner work, because so many of us seem to be outwardly focused. And whilst it's good to be focused on what what's materializing, what's evolving out there. It's also very helpful to know that we can gain sovereignty, spiritual sovereignty, by going inside and doing the inner work, doing whatever we need to do to understand our threefold nature, that we have this incredible mind, we have this incredible body, and we have this ineffable spark of life within us. And so as we do our inner work, as we do our inner engineering, we begin to see that what we manifest on the outside as our very life, our relationships, our work, our experience, is caused by this inner sense of connectedness, inner sense of our energy. We get to, there's a few foundational elements, and I find these to be really helpful in having self-mastery. And we begin to establish this sense of grounded presence. And for me, I've been, as many of you know, I've been studying the Enneagram for, I'm in a year-long training program at the moment. And I just got back from Phoenix and had an amazing teacher, Marion Gilbert. And she is, she's been teaching us about the somatic Enneagram. And so as we turn our focus of attention inward, we start to see that we can establish this sense of grounded presence. And when we have this deep connection with ourself as being part of this interconnected, interrelated, interdependent whole, we start to realize that we have to be still and develop this sense of being on purpose right where we are, being centered in ourself, being sovereign to our own energy, our own wisdom, our own love, emotions, our actions. And so we establish this grounded presence and we develop an inner observer. And so we develop this way of just noticing what's going on inside us. The Enneagram teaches three centers of intelligence: the head, the heart, and the belly or the body. And we start to ponder these different centers of intelligence. And so we have our head center. We have this way of thinking and processing and being intellectual and gaining knowledge. And so we have this local mind that we get to develop. And many of us in Science of Mind and New Thought have spent a lot of time in gaining mastery over our mind and really understanding how the mind works and how to create new neural pathways through the help and support of neuroscience. And we start to see as we develop this inner observer that we have access to a greater mind, not just our local mind, but omniscience, the greater mind. And so we start to, through meditation, through mindfulness, we start to explore what that means. And we're not confined by our own ego structure or our own mind. We begin to move out and gain access to divine mind. And then we gain access to the local heart and the greater heart, the local body and the greater body. And so we build some inner awareness about where our energy and attention is focused within these three centers of intelligence. And through work and practice, we begin to build coherence between these three areas that we can gain great wisdom, not just about ourselves and our own energy and our own intelligence and imagination and all of that, but that we connect to the greater field with more intention. And so we develop this sense of grounded presence, we develop our inner observer, and then we build onto this art of the placement of attention. And we begin to see that we can put our energy and our attention into particular things that we deem important and interesting. And so this is just very brief little answer to what is spiritual sovereignty and how it makes a difference in your life. You're going to have to try it out and just see what being more mindful, going within, exploring these three centers of intelligence and how they might support you, Gina, in making wise decisions and aligning your thoughts with your words and with your actions. So I love this question. Thanks for giving me an opportunity to speak to it. And if anyone has a question you'd like us to explore here at Growing Edge Live, go ahead and email that to growingedgelive@gmail.com. All right, so now we're moving on to my very special guest. I have heard of Jim Lockhart throughout my years of being a minister within religious science and science of mind. And I am just so thrilled that we could sync our schedules here because he's not living in the United States. So Dr. Jim Lockhart is an ordained minister, teacher, speaker, author, blogger, coach, consultant, and thought leader. He was raised in Baltimore, Maryland, and he's currently living in Lyon, France with his wife, Dorian. Dorian? Is that how you say her name? Carter Lockhart, PhD. They are frequent presenters at international conferences in the spiritual, business, and academic fields. Jim was a keynote speaker at the Unity Convention in 2023, and I'm super excited about this. He'll be a speaker at the affiliated New Thought Network conference at Unity Village in October of this year, 2024. For 20 years, Jim served as a spiritual leader in the Centers for Spiritual Living in California, Florida, and Maryland. And he is an author and has written Being the Beloved Community, Creating the Beloved Community, and Sacred Thinking, which I know so many people have read. He serves the New Thought movement in many, many ways and capacities. And he is a certified presenter and coach of Spiral Dynamics Model, Theory U, the Q Process, Edge Walkers, and the SQ21 Spiritual Intelligence Coaching Programs. Woo! That's a lot. Welcome, welcome, Dr. Jim, to Growing Edge Live.
Thank you so much, Allie. It's really great to be with you today.
Yeah, and for I know that you are in Cabo San Lucas filming this as we speak. And just a little coincidence, me and a group of ministers are heading down that way on Monday. So maybe we'll bump into each other.
Yeah, we'll try to keep the town quiet for you when you get here. But it's pretty wild here. This is my first time here in a long time. So we're enjoying it very much.
Yeah, good. So I'd love to know a little bit about your background. I'd love to know, were you a spiritual child? Were you very interested in religion, spirituality? Were you aware of more going on behind the scenes than meets the eye? How were you as a little one? What's your evolutionary spiritual journey been like?
Yeah, well, I was raised as a Catholic in the Northeast, which means, you know, that, as Joseph Campbell said, that's quite a strong mythological background to come from, because you're sort of steeped in the stories and the right and wrongs and things like that. I went to Catholic school for 12 years. I had a lot of questions always. I mean, when I would hear some of the stories about, you know, God smiting people and killing the babies and things like that. And I was quickly, kind of quickly branded someone who asked too many questions. They called me a disturbing element in the class quite often. But I always had this sense of something beyond the real. I loved stories, not just the Bible, but I loved things like The Twilight Zone on TV and things that sort of talked about the possibility of the aspects of ourselves that we're not directly connected to or not directly aware of. So I always had that. And then, but I sort of got turned off in the religious sector. As soon as I left high school, I stopped going to church. I was really totally unaffiliated for about 20 years or 25 years. And I was a police officer, mostly in the area of Miami, Florida. And I was in the training unit, and a couple of the folks in the training unit said, you ought to try this place near where you live called the Science of Mind Center in Fort Lauderdale, because they actually use the psychology we teach here at the police academy in a spiritual context. And I just had to go see what that was about. And so I did. I wandered in one day in 1989, and I just stayed. You know, I stayed in the community. I started taking classes. I became a minister, and I left the police department in 1996. I took an early retirement and went into ministry full time. So the psychology we were using in the police academy and elsewhere in the police department was things like neuro-linguistic programming, self-image psychology, visualization, affirmation, things of that nature that were helping people to sort of increase their capacity in human awareness and human perception and their own ability to be competent. So that was really attractive to me. And what I found in the Science of Mind when I started going there was the idea that it wasn't just up to me and what I could imagine. I had access to a universal presence that I could turn things over to when I couldn't figure out exactly how to do it. And it expanded my capacity to accept more good, is the way I would put it. So I fell in love with the teaching. I fell in love with the ideas. I fell in love with the people. And I did active, what we would call pulpit ministry, for 20 years.
Beautiful. That's really intriguing that the police department was using some of the foundational things that we learn in, you know, reading the Science of Mind and becoming practitioners. It sounds like your practitioner training got started at the police department.
It really did. And, I was doing affirmations and visualization and things through a program that we used. And I became a trainer in that program. And every time a new academy class would come in, which at that time was every 2 weeks, we were starting a new class of 40 recruits, we would spend 3 days going through self-image psychology with them before they began their regular program. The idea being that we wanted them to have good self-image and see themselves into roles that maybe they couldn't really fully imagine themselves into, you know, because being a police officer at that time, it's always difficult. But at that time in South Florida was with the cocaine cowboys and all that stuff that was going on. It was a very difficult time to be entering police work. And so the department, I think in their wisdom, was willing to invest in that kind of training. And I certainly took advantage of it, in my life.
Yeah. Is that typical? Do you think other other states or counties are bringing on board these same things?
No. Well, in some cases, bits and pieces. We worked with a vendor called the Pacific Institute out of Seattle that they were at that point the largest provider of human potential training on earth. Mm-hmm. And most of their clientele were corporate and military. They worked with the Army General's College. They worked with the military academies. They worked with professional sports teams. And we were their only law enforcement client. And I think they never had another law enforcement client. So it wasn't something that most police agencies or public service agencies were using.
Well, that makes me feel good that that so many people are being affected by these teachings, this human potential training or in the military. That's really quite a surprise to me. Back then, back in in 89, that's kind of leading edge, I would say.
Yeah, I had a chance to work with military agencies at various times in my law enforcement career, and I was always impressed by the leading edge thinking that was going on in the military and in the Army. And then I worked with people in the Army, the Navy, the Coast Guard, and the Air Force. And they were on the edge. I mean, they were invested in finding out how to maximize their own ability to perform, how to create wisdom in the field so that you weren't making snap judgments that would go in the wrong direction. They wanted people to make good, clear decisions. They wanted their soldiers to be treated properly. And, you know, at that time in the 70s, you were also beginning to see women come into the military in larger numbers and more diversity and so forth. And the military was really a leader in that kind of thing and making it work. So I was always impressed when I worked with the Department of Defense folks.
Well, again, that feels good. I'm glad mm-hmm. that's going on. So you have served a couple different centers
yeah.
as lead or senior minister, is that correct?
Yeah, my own path in Science of Mind, I was in the Fort Lauderdale and took my classes there, and I became assistant minister for about a year there with Dr. Arlene Bump when she was the pastor. And then I left for Baltimore, my hometown, because it was the largest city in the U.S. at that time without a religious science community. Mm. And started a community there that still exists. And after about three and a half years there, I was called back to Fort Lauderdale as co-pastor. And that was, my family really wanted to go back to Florida. And it, you know, it just seemed like a logical thing for us to do. And then later in life, when I married my current wife, Dorian, I moved to California and became co-pastor in Westlake Village, California, with Dr. Sue Rubin, which was my wife's center. And in the meantime, in 2003, I was elected to the board of Religious Science International. Actually, my wife and I were elected the same time. That's when we met. And 2 years later, we got married. So it was a typical board of directors relationship, I tell people, you know. We're the only people I know that met on a board of directors and got married.
That's interesting. So
I was there in Westlake for about 3.5-4 years, and I went over to Simi Valley after Dr. Dennis Merritt Jones left, which was 20 minutes away. And I was there for about 6.5 years, and I retired in 2015 from there.
Mm, interesting. My husband's from that Oak Park and Westlake Village
oh,
area.
Yeah. We lived in Oak Park, yeah.
Oh, okay, good.
Yeah.
Good. So, how was that for you being a pulpit minister? Was that something, a stepping stone? Obviously, you're not doing that now.
Well, I didn't see it as a step. There wasn't anywhere to step to, I guess, when you're leading a congregation, leading a community. I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed the organizational aspects. I loved to teach. Even most of the time I was in law enforcement, I was in a teaching capacity, at least part time. And for a while, I was the commander of the police academy in Dade County, Florida. And so I loved that aspect of training and learning and so forth. So that's what attracted me within the Science of Mind community, was it was more a teaching than a preaching.
Right.
And so I loved that. I loved speaking, and I loved teaching, and I loved working with people and seeing them wake up and seeing them their lives improve and so forth. The decision to leave was really more of a co-decision with my wife and I, that it was time to start a new chapter. And that's when we sold everything we owned in California, house, cars, and furniture. And we traveled full-time for 3 years, lived out of a suitcase,
wow.
just to see what was next. And that's when I wrote my first book, or my first book on the Beloved Community series. I'd written Sacred Thinking a number of years before that. And I saw my ministry unfolding as being a consultant to spiritual leadership in terms of understanding how to confront the changing times we're in mm-hmm. and how to best, you know, operate within these times and to thrive within these times. Mm-hmm. And so that became the focus. I was traveling, moving around. So everything I was doing pretty much was online. Occasionally when I'd be in the U.S., you know, I would do some things in person or whatever, but we were out of the U.S. probably 80 or 90% of the time during those 3 years. And then
wow.
we found Lyon and decided to settle there.
Yeah, I want to get to that maybe after our break.
Yeah.
But before we do, has there been someone that's been really significant in all of this for you? I know what it's like to run a church, and there's a lot of support within those walls and within organizations like CSL. But has there been someone, like over the course of your life, that really sort of implanted this desire for going deeper?
That's a good question. When I look early on, I would say my mother, who was a devout Catholic, and she was a convert to Catholicism. She wasn't raised in it. And I think it's safe to say converts tend to be a little more serious over time than many people that are born into it, because you're there very much on your own volition. My dad, on the other hand, was agnostic, and he didn't attend church, and he didn't believe in what the Catholics were teaching, and he was always frustrated having to pay my Catholic school tuition instead of going to public school and things like that. So I was kind of in that space of where questioning came kind of naturally. But I also recognized the value of the organization and the institution, that I didn't become a total rebel where you reject everything that the institution says. I tried to give the institution or the people in it the benefit of the doubt. They're doing the best they can. You don't tend to run into people in New Thought that are intentionally doing negative things or anything like that. Sometimes, like any of us, we're not up to the task at any given point. But it did lead me into more of a questioning and deepening, and I got into then people like Teilhard de Chardin and Joseph Campbell and Carl Jung, and in New Thought circles, Thomas Troward and Emma Curtis Hopkins. And I really found that I resonated more with the deeper thinkers and feelers than I did with some of the surface things that happen. A lot of times our Sunday service is kind of a surface thing. It's a brief talk, and you've got music, and it's getting people into a space of, community and joy, but you're not going deep into the material because, A, there isn't time, and B, a lot of those folks aren't interested in that. They're interested in coming together and having a nice experience and then going home. And, it's in class and other places where we really go deeper or have the opportunity to anyway. So I like that structure, and I like the design of it, whether it was totally intentional or not over time. But now we're in a place where the Sunday go to meeting thing that's been around for 1,000 years or so is going away. It's, it's diminishing in terms of how people, and I'll use this term intentionally, how we consume spirituality. And the absolute sacredness of Sunday is gone. The stores are open, the little league teams are playing, all the things that used to be moved to the side so that people could go to church are now, in this secular time, are now open and going on, and you're kind of in competition with them. And a lot of people are just saying, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't like the organizational piece. There's a million different reasons why people are reducing their attendance. I live in France, the most secular nation on earth, where less than 1% of people go to church go to any kind of worship regularly. And in the latest poll, 51% of the French people say they're not part of any religion. So, when I speak to many groups in North America, I say I come from the future, because France is your future.
Yeah, that's really
interesting. We're seeing that tendency move along there. It's not that they're not capable of spirituality; it's that they're resistant to organized religion. And the spirit and whatever spiritual benefits they might get from it, they're just not open to.
Yeah, I'm from England, and I spend quite a bit of time there. My family's still there, and I think it's similar. Yeah. There's not really an interest like there used to be. When you're talking about things open on Sundays, are things open in France on Sundays? Because I know in England, they're not so much.
Most on Sunday morning in France, there's the food stores might be open for a few hours. The florist shops are open, and the pastry shops are open, because people are going to get flowers and pastry and go to their family home for dinner, But by noon, everything's closed.
Yeah.
And yet nobody's going to church. So it's kind of an interesting experience. So the parks are full of people and people are walking along the rivers and, you know, and so forth.
Sounds lovely. Well, we're going to take a short break and we'll be right back.
Free my mind, open my heart with the whispers of truth, to live a conscious life, to live a conscious life on the growing edge. On the growing edge.
And now, here's Allie.
We're back. I would love to continue talking a little bit about the future of I don't really want to say religion per se, but the future of our spiritual journey together, as it's things are falling apart, or you know, we're transcending some of the old ways of doing things in regards to spiritual community, especially with, you know, within a religious organization. But I know that, you know, reading the books that you've written about community, beloved community, and knowing that you've moved to another country and there isn't, doesn't sound like there's a lot of a, you know, new thought. I don't know if that's there. So what are you getting a sense of as far as where are we headed? Maybe we start with New Thought in particular. How do we move forward? I know for me, I moved away from pulpit ministry during the pandemic and the lockdown, and it became completely uninteresting to me personally. And so I moved my ministry online, and we do have some people that meet locally still, but I haven't really engaged that much in that. But there's a longing to connect. There's a longing to be connected with other humans. But the idea of a religious community, or so, do you have thoughts about New Thought community and what the next phase might be in regards to this teaching?
Yes, I have many thoughts about it. I would say, if we take it in a context of an evolutionary pattern, where evolution is something that tends to move toward greater complexity. So we see that in biological evolution, we see it in cosmic evolution, where the universe started out with just nitrogen and time, and now we have all these different elements and all these different planets and stars and systems and life forms and so forth. And life began as single-celled organisms. Even before that, there were organisms that weren't even cells yet. And now we have the, you know, us ourselves with trillions of cells that are integral and working together and things like that. And evolution tends to move. I think it's helpful to think of it as a fluid thing, not a series of snapshots, but more like a movie or a river flowing. And there are times when it's flowing very quickly, like through the rapids, and there are times when it's kind of seen still, where there's not much happening. And then all of a sudden, something will begin to happen. And I think we're in a transitional state from, in terms of our own spiritual way that we consume religion and spirituality. We were in a fairly static state for a long time. You know, Sunday go to meeting, Saturday go to meeting, whatever it was. And it was regularly people gathering with certain kinds of structures or forms that were very similar. And we're beginning to see that lose momentum, if you will. And we're in a period where we don't know what, if anything, is going to replace it, or something will replace it. But I don't think it's going to be one thing. I don't think we're going to have another version of Sunday go to meeting that'll somehow show up in the next 5 or 10 or 15 years. I think we're going to have, like what we're beginning to see already, dozens and dozens and dozens of formats for people to engage in spirituality or religion or many other things as well. So the kinds of skills that are going to be called forth are really pioneering skills of being able to say, I'm stepping into an unknown. No one is fully prepared because no one knows what's going to happen. but I'm willing to step out on those skinny branches, if you will, where the support isn't there, in order to try something new. And we're seeing people doing that, like what you're doing with this format. And there's all kinds of things popping up, and probably most of them won't stick. You know, most of them will, or will only, won't last over a long time, that will be in a time of continuous reinvention, a time of a lot of people moving around and moving from here to there and stepping back for a while and stepping back in a different place and all that. And that's difficult because we want stability. You know, when they did a survey a number of years ago, what are the two things that people want most? And the number one was certainty. Hmm. And number two was uncertainty. So, you know, we sort of want to know what's coming, but we don't want to know exactly what's coming. We like to be surprised. We like to have new things showing up. And I think that's where we are. We're in a place where if you're not ready for innovation, if you're not ready to let go of some of the sacred cows that you've been holding on to, then you're going to get stuck. You're going to get stuck in between things, not in one or the other, but you're going to get stuck in between things. And that's an extremely uncomfortable place to be.
Hmm.
So that's a general kind of an idea. And all that's happening within bigger concentric circles all the way out to the global population of things that are in transformation, you know, from global warming to the political structures and the way they're being affected and the way we do business and online versus offline and just all those other kind of revolutionary things that are unfolding. That we're not separate from, we're not unaffected by.
Yeah, I can see there's some people that really love the idea of newness and fresh starts and the idea of evolution or, you know, personal evolution. Our lives become different. And like you said, you went for a round traveling for 3 years. My husband and I did it for 1 year. We got rid of everything and went around the country in our camper van, and it definitely shakes things up, you know, from being so fixed on the earth in a particular home with all your creature comforts and then going off into a new experience, a new adventure. That can be challenging for people. And I see, as I look out and take a glimpse to look at the political scene or take a glimpse to look at the, you know, what's going on spiritually or what's going on in the world, the wars, the this and the that, it can be very, it's overwhelming. And I see it that a lot of people are trying to hold on to the way things were, to some idea that they can hold on, they can keep things the same somehow. And then there's others that don't seem to be as interested in that. So I think it's interesting to see that we're all, it feels like, and whenever anyone says that, oh, this seems like a really volatile time, it's always felt that way. I think there's always been wars going on, and that this really does seem like a volatile time. Things are being shaken up, and we are being called to rise, to take the next evolutionary step, whatever that might be. What do you do are you impacted by the craziness that we can be inundated with when we turn on the news or listen to the shopkeeper down the street, you know, or the people talking about it at the coffee places? You know, it can be overwhelming.
Yeah. Well, I think that's something that we have to come to terms with is, and you mentioned it in terms of spiritual sovereignty earlier on, is what I have to do is to develop myself internally so that I'm the best version of myself, whatever that is. I mean, Carl Jung called that your soul's agenda, that your soul wants you to be the fullest expression of who you are or who you came here to be. And we often kind of step back from that because it feels scary. It feels like we won't be accepted, or it feels like we'll rock the boat too much, or we'll fall off the boat. And these are the things I try to focus on when I work with spiritual leaders is, you know, Nobody knows where we're going. We don't have any models for the future that we can rely on. But what people need to see is both confidence and competence in dealing with an unknown. And which also we need to see vulnerability as part of that. That, yeah, things do knock me off center. I am affected by the craziness. I am greatly saddened by some of the beliefs that people have accepted as true, some of the conspiracy theory type things, or, you know, whatever it may be. There's plenty of them to go around. And I've had a lot of people that I've been very close to that I feel like they're just gone. But you can't even have a conversation with them anymore. And, you know, it does two things. It saddens me. It also makes me look at my own sense of what I believe and say, is that true? I mean, you know, I like to say, I like my healthy self to take this under advisement and see if it makes sense to me. Does my inner gyroscope stay in line as I pursue a specific pathway or a specific set of beliefs? And if it doesn't, then I need to examine that. I need to say, okay, how do I need to adjust internally so that I'm more up to the whatever this task is that's coming? It's really hard, and it's not going to get easier. What we can do is just to try to, the thing, you know, there's sort of a conflict in a sense between, should we be in spiritual community, or is this a solo path to grow my own self spiritually? And I think it's both. I think we have to, you know, go, as it says in the Bible, go into your closet and talk to the spirit within in private, but we also have to be in community and support one another so that I'll do better on my individual path if I'm supported in a community around me. And the reality is, at work or at home, I may not get that support. Hmm. So having a community of people, whether it's online or in person or some hybrid version, I think is critically important. I think it's important that we have teachers along the way that maybe are a little bit ahead of us or can help us to see things within ourselves that we're not quite ready to see. So, you know, I don't think we can do it without a teacher. You know, you see a lot of these memes online saying that, you know, all organized religion is bad. Well, if I don't have any organized religion in my life, I probably won't have any sense of spirituality except what I make up on my own. And I'm going to spend a lot of time going down false alleys that could have been avoided by having some teachers along the way. But I have to learn how that I have to do, expect myself to outgrow the teacher. And the teacher, if it's a good teacher, expects me to outgrow them. And that's something that we often lose because the ego gets in the way. And, you know, we see all the people that are in leadership that misbehave. But I've had some teachers that have misbehaved, but I've learned from them. And I'm proud of that. You know, Joseph Campbell says, my enemies make me proud. And what he's speaking to there is an idea of having a pure sense of self that allows you to evaluate the behaviors of others in relation to that. It's not about making them wrong, but they're not right for me. Mm-hmm. So my ego then says, well, they have to be defeated. But, you know, let's step away from that. Let's expand that ego so it's no. Let's live and let live to the point, as long as you can keep yourself safe. But I appreciate having some of the stuff reflected back to me that I need to work on. You know, mm-hmm. the shadow stuff that we project onto others and we get angry at them and try to control their behavior until you say, oh, wait a minute, it's not about them, it's about me. So that's all part of it. And I think I credit my law enforcement training and experience of having to go into buildings by myself where there were bad guys. And you know, because I think I went into law enforcement because I didn't have a sense of personal authority. And I thought I could wear it. Mm-hmm. And over time, I began to see, hey, I'm pretty good at this. I can do this. I can get better at it. I don't have to rely on the badge to be my whole authority, whereas some others never kind of got to that. So I think when we're younger, we tend to subconsciously go into activities and maybe careers where we're going to be called forth in a way that's very uncomfortable, you know, and I certainly did that. And I've seen, I certainly did that in ministry too, because my, my growth spiritually in terms of any kind of formal structure was very lacking. So I began to realize if I'm going to live this teaching, I need to be a minister. I need to do it full time. And that was a very maybe selfish way to go into the to that that career, but it, it certainly was part of my decision making.
Interesting. So how, what's it for, like for you now? How long have you been in Lyon?
We've been there for 6 years.
6 years.
We own an apartment. And it's a lovely life. The Europeans have been doing it longer than the North Americans, at least other than the indigenous North Americans. But they kind of have how to live down pretty well. I mean, I'll give you an example that I treasure. They don't let the big stores into the city, except at two malls. So there's no huge shopping center, huge grocery stores. So in my neighborhood, I go out every day and shop mid-morning. And I go to the greengrocer, I go to the cheese shop, I go to the baker for my baguette, I go, you know, to the fishmonger for the fish or whatever, the butcher. And every part of the city has their own set of little mom and pop stores. And they know you the second time you come in. So it's really like small town living, very accessible, walkable. We don't own a car, we don't need a car. And it's a real sense of community that's just lovely.
Yeah.
And it's much easier to eat healthily there. And they have outdoor markets, like we would call farmers markets, in different parts of the town almost every day of the week. And some of them have 200 and 300 stalls. So you can get anything there and everything's fresh and everything's right from the farm and so forth. So from that kind of standpoint, I'd say quality of life, it's something that's very hard to copy in the U.S.
Yeah, I've always felt like that would be an answer. Like if I was to become the leader of the world, I would say, or at least the country, going back to small communities, being, you know, working together and buying and growing locally and having that sense of sovereignty, I guess, you know.
And I'm in a city of 2 million people living this
way. Wow.
So it's possible within, even within that kind of density.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
So what about spiritual community? Do you have any spiritually minded people that you're there with? Or is this, how do you fill that cup for yourself?
Well, my French has not developed as quickly as I would have liked. So most of my social activity is with people that speak English. And there's a large expat community there. We have an American club. And, you know, I know folks from Great Britain and so forth. Not too many that we have spiritual conversations with. I do a lot of it online. There's a center in Geneva, a small center that's about 2 hours by train. I've done some things with them over time. But in France itself, there was a study group for a while, but it doesn't exist anymore. But there's a lot of folks that are into integral. They're into the Ken Wilber kinds of stuff and the spiritual side of that. And, you know, you can talk with the French about philosophy all day long. They will not talk about spirituality because they consider it personal. So if you say spiritual, something spiritual, that's it. The conversation's over in no uncertain terms. But if you talk about the philosophy of this person or that person or psychology, then, yeah, that's fine. So you know, that happens quite a bit. But again, my limitation is I can't really do a lot in French yet. I'm still studying. Hopefully that'll change.
So you're hoping to become fluent at some point?
Yeah, at least conversational. I don't think they say it takes 30 years to become fluent in your own language.
Wow.
In terms of really understanding, you know, to that level. And they say when you learn a new language, after you get mechanically proficient, it takes 6 more years to become yourself in that language.
Oh my gosh.
Because up to then, you're just kind of, you know, you have a limited set of vocabulary and grammatical things that you're able to use effectively and so forth. So it's a challenging thing. You know, I know people that have been in France for 30 years that they'll find a whole section of conversation that they don't know the vocabulary for. You know, just because they hadn't been exposed to it or hadn't had to deal with it. So it's a little more difficult. But the interesting thing is, almost everybody in Europe speaks 2 or 3 or 4 languages. Because it's like if in the U.S. every state had its own language, you would learn the languages probably of some of the states near you.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're 2 hours from Switzerland and a couple hours from Germany and a couple hours from Italy. So there's quite a bit of bilingual and trilingualism from people that are native.
Are there any meditation groups or anything of that sort?
Yeah, there are. There are different things like that, yoga and so forth. We're right near Plum Village, Thich Nhat Hanh place, and then Taizé, the Catholic community of where you can do retreats and so forth, is about an hour drive from us. So there are places, and of course we have the amazing cathedrals and churches that you can go in and meditate and so forth. All the churches in France are owned by the government. That happened after the revolution. So, but they let the church use it for free. So, you know, that's why you can go into a huge church there on Sunday morning and there'll be that seats 700 or 800 people and there's 25 people there. You know, that's how they can afford to do that. And so it's quite interesting. It's, you know, it's a little disconcerting at first, but you get used to it. And, you know, the people there are very ethical and moral and they live very good lives. Very little concern about stuff like that.
Wonderful. So I always end the show with this question. What does the world need now? We've heard the song, you know, the world needs love. But what does today, what do you think people need?
To wake up to what is already true about them. That sense of awareness that we already have enough, we are enough, we have the capacities to do whatever we need to do in our own lives. And we need, one of my favorite quotes I think of often from Emerson is, to get your bloated nothingness out of the way and let the divine circuits flow.
There you go. You heard it here from Dr. Jim Lockhart. Get your bloated nothingness out of the way. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today. It's been really wonderful to hear what you have to say, given your rich life experience. And it's really touched me, and I know it's touched our viewers and listeners. So thank you, Dr. Jim.
Thank you. It's been an honor, and I look forward to seeing you in person in October in at Unity.
Yes. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, everyone. Thank you to New Thought Media Network, and thank you to our sponsor, the Satya Center, who offers all kinds of classes and counseling if you want. And we'll see you next week. We have Stowgood, the musical group, as our guest, and peace and blessings, lots of love to you wherever you are, and I'll see you next week. Goodbye.
Free my mind, open my heart with the whispers of truth, to live a conscious life, to live a conscious life on the growing edge.